Welcome to the Angus Table, the podcast from Angus Australia. I'm Scott Wright, the CEO at Angus Australia. Each episode will bring conversations with breeders, industry leaders, innovators, insights, stories and ideas that matter and hopefully add value to your Angus operation. Whether it's genetics, markets, pasture management, marketing experts or people shaping the breed, this is where the Angus community pulls up a chair at the Angus Table. Thanks for joining us. Welcome back to the Angus Table podcast. This is part two of my fascinating conversation with John Condon. If you haven't listened to part one yet, go and do that as you can hear John tell us his story about starting Beef Central and the challenges involved. We pick up this second part of the interview discussing sustainability and what John predicts for the next 10 years. John, if we flick to the other side of the industry, you interview a lot of people, you've probably got a pretty good overview of this new sustainability world that we live in. How do you see carbon and sustainability shaping the beef industry in the next 5 to 10 years? What do you think of the trends?
Yeah, I think the full story is yet to play out. I mean, I think we're at level one of a 10-level sort of a high-rise building. And until we get on top of the measurement systems and come up with reliable, accurate, easy-to-access and implement reporting systems, I think, you know, we're still going to have our training wheels on in this space. I think every property in Australia in 10 to 20 years will have some sort of a carbon project on it. I just think it's a no-brainer. Is it going to be for everybody? Possibly not. But I think for the people who can see an opportunity, they're very surprised that we don't see it much more widespread. We've only had our Carbon Central platform operating for, I think it's 3 years or 4 years. And the appetite for that content on our sites has grown dramatically over that period. So there were some early adopters and innovators who jumped in very early in this space and established projects. I think each year that goes by, the interest in the topic is growing, and obviously the customer base is continuing to emerge too, with large corporates for all sorts of reasons looking to offset some carbon credits and seeking credits to offset their emissions and things. I don't think this is a fad. I think this is here permanently in the industry. It's my own personal opinion. Well, I think it will be a fundamental part of the revenue stream of most cattle enterprises in years to come.
Interesting. Won't be long and we'll know the answer to that, isn't it, John? It is an Angus podcast. John, what's your perception from the outside of the Angus cattle industry as a sub-industry? And what do you think our members should be thinking about to stay ahead of the game?
It's interesting to look at the evolution, and I'm based in Brisbane, so my perceptions are much more coloured by the northern half of Australia. I don't spend a lot of time in southern New South Wales, Victoria, South Australia, so I tend to have a somewhat distorted perspective of the world. But, you know, for the first 10 years of my working life as a journalist, I never saw an Angus beast in a sale yard, in a paddock. In Queensland, I'm talking about, different on the yes. New England. But you had to get to Gundawindi or further south before you'd start seeing any black cattle at all back in the 1980s. I mean, I started riding in 1981, so we're talking about a long time ago. Sale yards back then, Dolby, Idesville, Taroom, you name it, they were full of Herefords and Sanders the further north. You start getting into some Sanders and then you get up to CQ and there was bunches of Chardonnays and, you know, a more tropically adapted breeds. I rarely, if ever, saw an Angus beast in the early 80s. So, you know, we're talking about a transition, which is 40 years, 30 years. But what an incredible transformation it's been. And, you know, again, I come back to this issue of quality and the establishment of large corporate brand programs where marbling is a key part of the factor. Some of them are breed specific, some of them not. But marbling obviously is a key part of the chilled meat category. And what it's played strongly into the Angus suite of offering, if you like. So, you know, extraordinary how the dynamics have changed in the last 20 to 30 years. And, you know, there would not be a large grain-fed or even grass-fed beef export processor these days that doesn't have either an Angus specific brand, very large, or a a marbling oriented brand that they putting an awful lot of Angus product into. So it's all being driven by demand. The fact that they can put that product into an export market in a chill form, do more with it. You know, there's always going to be a generic 100-day grain-fed product in Australia just to feed the masses, and good pub steak, let's face it. That's probably where that trade goes. But for everything above that level, people want something a little bit more. And in my opinion is consumers worldwide these days, in the developed economies, it's a quality over quantity play. The old days of a 500, 400-gram steak are probably gone. People are much happier with a 250, 300-gram steak on a plate, which eats exceptionally well. And, you know, the T-bone that covers the size of the dinner plate is should be, and I think to a large extent, is gone from the industry. And, you know, that's really been a core part of the Angus success, in my opinion.
Is there anything we should be looking over the horizon and being aware of? Do you think Angus producers need to be ahead of the game? Is there some warning signals, or is there anything we should be looking at as a Angus industry?
Yeah, I think what will happen will be, I think particularly given some of the emissions imperatives and that sort of thing, I think the seed stock industry should be starting to look over the horizon a little bit and start now applying some selection pressure on feed efficiency, on the ability to convert feed into grain, reducing turnoff of cycles and this sort of thing. I don't think we need to wait, or we should be waiting, until we start seeing price signals. I think we need to do it now. And I think it's always hard to motivate people unless they see some financial incentive involved. But, you know, this is going to be the next big thing for the beef industry, is selecting cattle for efficiency, which looks good on our report card in terms of emissions. It keeps the costs down for feedlots and for grass producers, because I think everybody thinks about feed efficiency as only being a matter that's of interest to feedlots. It's not true. In all the research that I've seen suggests it is as applicable in a grass fed system as it is in grain.
Most certainly.
So I think I'd like to think that the industry can start being to preempt some of these coming changes a little bit more. Your breed is a unique, well, not so much opportunity, but you have a unique advantage in the field of poultness. And you know, whether it be good luck or good fortune or whatever, but, you know, for some reason, Angus are blessed without horns. And again, you know, in some parts of Australia where some horned breeds are starting to become encroached in bigger numbers. I'm talking about Wagyu, and I don't mind talking about it by name. We're seeing the horn status going backwards in some regions because of the introduction of Wagyu bulls into herds. It worries me, given the animal welfare challenge that this broader industry faces, and we need to get on top of these things as quickly as we can. Other breeds have made some solid progress in moving to a poll status, and I think it's a little bit, I think we need to be careful how we interpret it, particularly through groups like the Australian Beef Sustainability Framework. In their report cards, they're using seed stock numbers to report on poultness, where that's generations away for the commercial cattle industry. I think if you did some sort of a serious poll of the degree of extent of poll cattle in the commercial industry, it would be way worse than what we're seeing in the seed stock registrations. We've got to move down this path as quickly as we can. The whole idea about dehorning cattle, I think, is very quickly going to become unacceptable.
Yeah, the consumer.
Absolutely. And that's with or without pain relief. We just need to be moving down these paths a lot more quickly than we are. You're fortunate. Your breed's already there. And what a great advantage you've got in that space.
It is. It is very important. It's very good. John, from a seed stock perspective, you see sales avatars on the platform. You see bull sales across the country. What's some take-home lessons that you observe for our Angus stud breeders that are marketing their bulls? Is there any bits of wisdom that you feel for them?
Look, I'm going to be a little bit controversial here, Scott. I've been selling bull sale ads to Angus breeders and other breeds for 44 years. I think I haven't seen a lot of change in the way those ads appear since the 1980s.
That's interesting that you say that.
Now, this is in both print and in digital form. Because a digital form ad, to a large extent to me, is a series of three or four slides, which each sells a little message. But effectively, what I see, the most common ad we get on Beef Central, and as I still see in rural weekly newspapers, there's a picture of a bull, there's the name of the sale, what day it's on, how many bulls are off it, and who the agent is, maybe. Now, it is that formatted, it's that locked into a very tired old formula, doesn't sell the sizzle. It does not sell the sizzle. All it does is it's a date claimer. I think they could do a hell of a lot better. And some do. Not enough. Not enough. I think we are locked into this format in terms of advertising through media outlets particularly that is old-fashioned, outdated, mundane, and I don't think they're getting their best value for money in the way they're presented. I think there's ways that people can initiate and do things a little bit more in a more creative way that should be explored more frequently.
Do you see some good examples?
I see some ads I think are absolutely great. In fact, I do have a few parked away for reference, and most of them don't even contain a photo of a bull.
Interesting.
Because they've always contained a link through to a catalogue or somewhere else which has got all of the detail anybody ever wants to see, EBVs and pictures and everything else. I think that some of the best ads I've ever seen are the ones that don't have any bull photos whatsoever, but they're selling a message. Yeah. They're selling a message. And it could be, you know, a pot of gold, which basically is saying, you know, our bulls are going to make you more money, and then provide some sort of explanation why. So I would love to see more start advertisers that may need some help from an agency or somebody with some marketing smarts, and you guys produce a lot of ads for your customers, and maybe you can have a little bit more influence in some of their output. And I don't want to make any more work for you than you've already taken on, but it's an area where I haven't seen change in some of these ads in 44 years.
Yeah, it's a very interesting observation as probably the person in the industry that's seen more ads for stud sales than anyone else. Mm. That's a good point. John, your publication is, or not publication, website has to really cover politics and agri-politics. How do you find the beef industry is full of agri-politics? It seems to attract it. Controversial at times, and you cover a lot of that. Who, from your point of view, are some of those people that have made a real difference in a positive way to the beef industry that you've observed?
Yeah, we've been blessed by having a bunch of really good communicators at different times in the industry. And I think we've been fortunate enough to see those people come along at times when it's really been needed. So the people that really left an impression on me in terms of being able to deliver a message, sell a concept to the industry, probably the earliest one that I can recollect was Dick Austin, who was the Australian Meat and Livestock Corporation chairman back in the days prior to MLA's launch in 1997. Dick was a strong communicator. Believe it or not, at the same time that he was the chairman of AMLC, he was also the chairman of the Australian coal industry. So he was juggling both jobs at once, and did it very well. Didn't seem to suffer as a result of trying to manage the interests of two separate industries. Dick, I saw perform particularly. There was a hostile audience at a gathering of beef producers in Rockhampton back in the cattlemen union days. And I forget specifically what the topic was, but Dick stepped in there and did an absolutely consummate job of selling the message, pulling that largely militant group back in onto his side of the ledger again. And that takes great skill. The more modern ones that come to mind, well, David Crombie is a no-brainer. And David came out of obscurity to take on the MSA Steering Committee chairmanship in about 1994 or 5. Again, excellent communicator. Could sense the mood of the industry and the opportunity. He really, with some great support from some excellent administrators, he really sold the MSA concept to the industry at a time when it wasn't particularly palatable. Yes. It was seen as a way of processes driving certain breeds out of the industry or manipulating price or whatever else. David did an excellent job of driving the MSA evolution and its ultimate launch in 1997. He then, of course, took on the chairmanship of MLA later on, and later still National Farmers Federation. David really stood out as an exceptionally good communicator and somebody who was able to establish trust and that relationship with the grassroots producers. I mean, there's been plenty of others. I think people like Malcolm Foster was an exceptionally good communicator for the feedlot industry. Don Mackay was another one who really, in his roles both with Alpha and then later through the Red Meat Advisory Council, you know, exceptionally good at engaging with industry and selling those messages. What I don't like in the modern era is how the board chair of MLA particularly has become somewhat of a discreet position. They no longer engage with industry at all, apart from the AGM. So we've come out of an era and we had people like David Crombie, Don Heatley, who literally got out around the hustings and spoke to regional producers all over Australia. They felt it was part of their role as chairman. The modern era, the past two chairs and probably three, have chosen for whatever reason to completely disengage from the industry in a face-to-face level. Don't think it's a good thing for the how MLA is perceived in the bush.
Yes.
Leaving that to the MD and others, I think, is unfair and probably not appropriate. I think there should be a lot stronger connection between the board and the grassroots cattle and sheep producers, which hasn't really happened for the last 10 years.
Interesting. It's a good, probably a good lesson for a lot of organisations. That'll flow on, John. We've talked, you and I had chats at times about conferences. Rural industries follow them. What have you noticed about the change? We've talked about this a little bit. What are the trends you're seeing? Could be some worrying trends too, John, like we've chatted about. What stands out to you?
Yeah, I, as part of my daily job, of course, I have to go to an awful lot of conferences, as do our other staff as well. I certainly don't do them all myself, but having done as many as I have over the years, I think, you know, they continue to play a really, really important role in getting these key messages out to stakeholders, and that's regardless whether it's a feedlot conference at BeefX or an Angus conference or a live export or Cattle Australia or whatever. But, you know, they're absolutely vital to have. But one of the trends that's concerned me a little is the tendency to, it's all part of the sponsorship process, where there is a tendency to trickle in sponsors into the speaking part of the programs. And in some conferences, it gets way out of alignment. And I know it's all part of, you know, doing deals to come up with the funds that all of these organisations need to run these events. But I think it's got to a point where it's damaging the value of conferences in some cases. Not all, but some. And there are clearly spots which are being put up for on panel sessions or on just as general speaking spots, which are there to appease a sponsor rather than, is this the next most important piece of information we can deliver to our delegates? So that worries me. It's probably got worse in the last 3 to 5 years, I would suspect. I think it's somewhat insulting to the people who are sticking their hand in their pocket to pay a $300-$500 delegates fee, which a lot of them are these days. They're not cheap events to go to. I'd like to think that that time could be better used by putting on a speaker of serious, significant importance rather than simply sacrificing it. I think it also is being reflected. There's a conference coming up soon, which is a large national organisation where they have engaged on a topic where I think they've gone a bit soft on one of the service providers in this field. I'm not going to name which one it is, but I think they've gone a bit soft in terms of their response to them. And sure enough, you're going to have a look at the sponsorship profile for their upcoming conference. And here is that same organisation. And I can't help but wonder whether that has been their sort of attitude about that has been coloured by the fact they've got them sitting there at a speaker's concert.
Interesting.
The other one that I don't like about the conferences these days, and this is technology coming at us, and I fully appreciate that it's pretty hard to hold some of this back, but I go to a lot of conferences now where the Q&A sessions, which I think are absolutely critically important to any conference, and I would advise virtually every conference organiser. Have a look through your program. Pull out one of those speakers to allow for a little bit more time for some interaction between the audience and the speakers. And I often see them being overly ambitious with how many speakers they put up, and they literally run out of time for questions.
Yeah.
And I think the opportunity is there. The unfortunate part in modern conferences, a lot of them tend to use these conference apps. I think there's several of them out there that people use. Rather than having a roving mic wandering around the room where people can line up and ask a question verbally in front of the audience and in front of the, I think these apps, where we're basically sending a text to somebody, they become sanitised. They often lose the context and the sort of, you know, why the person is asking the question. A lot of this just gets lost in translation when you're just writing a three-line text. And also, I think there are plenty of examples where the organisers can see all these questions piling up. The ones that I don't particularly like, they just hit the delete button. And so you end up with these flowery, somewhat, what's the word for it, supportive sort of comments which don't really add to a lot to the dialogue. So I might be old school, but I much prefer the chance for people to get up, interrogate the speaker with a serious question about something, and I think the audience gets greater benefit out of that. So in that field, you know, there's a couple of things there with the conferences that I go to I think we can do better with.
Yeah, okay. No, good observations. John, and we've certainly had that experience this year with our World Forum. I'd probably concur with you with most of that, and especially if we want grassroots members, farmers to attend, they can see through things pretty quickly, can't they? John, could have probably getting a bit more personal to you. What was it like leaving secure paid employment and betting it all on a business venture? It's not unlike a lot of our members of what they've done or young people doing that. What did you learn from that experience? And what would you say to maybe someone listening today that might be in a similar position?
Yeah, well, people keep telling James and I that, you know, we did take a risk when we started our business. At the time, I must say, I don't think we necessarily really saw it that way. We had done a lot of research. I think we'd convinced ourselves that the model was sound. So it wasn't simply just stepping off a cliff. No, we did a lot of research. We spoke to a lot of potential supporters financially for the business. I might just share on that. We went to two very large corporates seeking some financial support for our project, one being the National Australia Bank, the other being Zoetis, the biggest animal health company in the world. And I pitched our idea to a fellow called Mike Van Blommestein, who then ran Australia and New Zealand for Zoetis, which was then Pfizer, but it obviously changed name at a later stage. So I sort of gave Mike this 5-minute spiel about what we were doing and why we were trying to do it. He was acutely aware, I think, at the time that advertisers literally had one choice in most states about where they spend their dollar. And a little bit of competition in any space, regardless of whether you're breeding bulls or trying to produce news and markets intelligence for the beef industry, is a healthy thing. And Mike got it. And we got to the end. He said, "How much do you want?" And I wasn't quite prepared for that. And I looked at him and I gave him a figure, and he looked straight back at me and he said, "Double it."
Interesting.
Yeah.
So he believed in it.
He believed in the concept. So that sort of took the wind out of our sails a little bit. What it did, what it was that, and also the support we received, similar support from NAB, it gave us the financial security not to worry about paying our bills the next week.
Yes.
So we were in a position where James and I could focus on what we felt we did best, and that was producing content that people would want to read. We didn't have to worry about the next week's income.
That's great.
And
that's real confidence, isn't it?
Yeah, well, it was, and we're forever grateful to those companies for doing that for us.
Have they stuck with you, John?
Absolutely. Absolutely. 15 years, they're still there.
Really good.
And so, you know, we're blessed by having a bunch of core advertisers who have just been so generous in supporting our business and sort of get what we're trying to do. And those two particularly have been with us from day one, have never left. But, you know, it's allowed us to do what we want to do in terms of producing a quality product, and we're very proud of that. But in terms of, what was the other part of the question?
Advice to a young person, maybe in that similar position.
Yes, okay. I think the most important piece of information I can give to a young journalist, particularly in the ag space, but it applies almost in any part of journalism, is to, as quickly as you can, specialise in something. I think, and whether that be podcast production or becoming an expert in health media or agricultural media or whatever, I think it adds a lot of strings to your bow if you can develop quickly some expertise in a particular field. Best to do it in a field that they're interested in. Makes sense, right? But whether you're a finance journalist or a beef journalist or a fashion journalist, doesn't really matter. But just really embed yourself in that space. Become more than just a cub journalist.
Yes.
Get to know a field that you become really, really comfortable in. Doesn't mean you're going to spend the rest of your career in that space, but I think it improves your employability. It improves the quality of the information you're producing. So, yeah, if I had one piece of advice for a young journalist, it's that to become skilled in a particular area, whether it be a field or some techniques like what you're doing today with podcast recording and editing, a video, you know, things like that. I think having some extra strings to your bow is really, really important.
Good advice. In a range of fields, I think.
Yeah.
That's on. In terms of values that you bring into your work as an agricultural journalist, what always like to ask people, you know, one, two, three, four values that are pretty important to you as a person in your business. What are some values that you...
In our business? Yeah. You know, I think the thing that we value more than anything else is our staff and how we engage with our staff. I look more broadly at the beef industry. I see beef producers who are exceptionally good pasture managers, exceptionally good at managing genetics and animal health. You know, they've got so many skills in so many fields. The area they've never really had any training or education is managing people. And it's a key topic that we touch on in our weekly recruitment articles.
Yes.
Because I just think there's this huge deficit out there in the cattle industry in gaining an understanding about how to manage and affect and empower staff, more importantly, not just managing staff, but empowering staff to produce their best. And I think there is scope for groups like MLA or others to put courses on. You know, forget about grazing land management courses. That's important too. But how to get the best out of your staff? I think we should be doing a lot more in this space. We've worked hard in this space to recruit, well, people that we really think can offer something to our business, who are capable, but also empowering them at a young age to giving them independence and some responsibility, possibly before in some cases they feel they may be ready themselves. But it's amazing how you give people some of those opportunities, how they perform. Constantly amazes. I think the thing we're most proud about in our business is, we're coming up for 15 years next year. We currently employ 11 full-time staff and a bunch of contractors we plug in. In 14 and a half years, we've had, apart from retirements, which we've had a couple due to age, we've had one person leave the business in 14 and a half years. And I think that is because, I like to think it's because we create an environment that people get job satisfaction, they feel well regarded and rewarded, and are given a level of opportunity, which, you know, I think is important. I think that can apply equally as much in a cattle enterprise, whether it's got two staff or 30. And look, I don't think we're Robinson Crusoe in doing that by any means. I think there's lots of very successful cattle production businesses out there who have got incredible staff stories to tell. But equally, I think there's a lot that don't and have high turnover and possibly are, in some cases, desperately in need of some education and training in this space.
It's credit to you, John. It's a pretty stable tone.
Yeah.
You must have an ability also to find the right people too.
Yes.
You haven't had to manage people and their performance if you've got that good person, quality person coming in, makes your job a lot easier as a manager.
I think a small business, not only ours, but even at a cattle enterprise, you can't afford to carry any dead wood. You've got to make sure you make the right choice. But, you know, there's obviously still, it's a tough market out there to recruit staff. We see evidence of it every week in the job listings that we run on our website. You know, it's tough to find good people out there, and the good ones tend to stick. So it's even harder for people looking for a good staff member. Yeah. So, you know, I just think there's so much more the industry could do in this space. Whether that's MLA's role or not, I don't know. Maybe not. Maybe this is a feel for rimfire resources or agricultural appointments to move into, and it's something to provide some edge. It's a little bit like fields like succession planning. You know, that's not an MLA job, but there's obviously companies that have emerged which are doing a very good job in that space. And I think that there's potential to do more in that space in terms of managing people.
Interesting. There are good comments. John, it's a pretty relentless job, yours. I imagine you don't get much downtime. How do you switch off? How do you unwind?
Look, you know, I have a range of interests outside the beef industry, one of which is I do enjoy cooking. I love getting on the burners. I find it quite therapeutic, and I like to think of myself as quite creative in what I produce. I mean, I love nothing better than going and buying a whole rump and seaming it out myself and, you know, putting the centre cut over here for some steaks and the rump cap over here for a roast and the pillow steak, I'll say, yeah, I'll put that over here and we'll turn that into beef strips and that sort of thing. And I've rediscovered my old charcoal barbecue. I mean, like everybody, I've got a gas barbecue there that I use on a day-to-day basis, but I've also got a serious charcoal barbecue that I've sort of got into, because having time with charcoal is sort of something that sort of puts people off a little bit. But I really enjoy getting into the kitchen, and my wife is more than happy to let me take the lead in cooking at home. We're mostly only cooking for two these days. My kids have grown up and I've left home, but I do enjoy the food side. I mean, first thing I ever do when I go to a new city is go and have a look at a market.
Interesting.
Doesn't matter where I am, you know, if I'm going to Tokyo, I'll go to Tsuchiki Fish Market, or, you know, I just love getting in and seeing what the locals are eating, what they're doing with it, you know, what the local produce is like. I just love doing that. And beyond just beef, but, you know, I'm particularly interested in, like, I was in Melbourne only the other day, and I've been to the Queen Victoria markets probably 30 times and just couldn't help myself. I had to go back to Queen Vic markets again and just love the experience and just see what's going on, what people are buying. So, yeah, that's
great.
That's my little escape, probably more than anything else. That's the thing I really enjoy. During COVID, my obscure little hobby, I got into fish keeping. I needed something. We're all locked away at home. So I kept fish as a kid in Katherine. I used to go and catch rainbow fish and things out of the Katherine River and throw them in a tank. But I rediscovered fish keeping, which I enjoy. I've got a nice tank set up in my office, which if I'm tied up in a big long conversation on the telephone with somebody, I'll just go and sit there and stare into the tank for 10 minutes. So, you know, again, it's something completely different from what I do on a day-to-day sort of basis. And you know, I think that's the same for most people. You're looking for contrast with what you do on a day-to-day level, and that's sort of a couple of things that I'm interested in.
That's great. That's great. On your cooking, what would you say is your best beef eating experience that you've had?
One of the joys of my job is I do get to eat an awful lot of beef and very good beef. And, you know, I'm forever thankful for that, because I can put it away with the best of them. The one beef eating experience that stands out in my life, and I learned a lesson from this, it was in Florence, Italy, and a lot of the restaurants in Florence serve what they call a bistecca, which is like a double cut T-bone, sirloin on one side, fillet on the other, but harvested from a huge animal. And we're talking about Chianina's 450 to 500 kilos carcass weight, enormous cattle. And they've all got these little dry age cabinets out the front of the restaurants, showing off what they're selling. What struck me about these things in these dry age cabinets was how lean they were. I mean, these things were like a skinned rabbit. They had no fat on them whatsoever. But lovely pink meat, And, you know, so we sat down and had one of these bistecas, big enough to feed probably three or four. I think there were three of us. And it just left me with the most incredible experience in terms of eating quality.
So, and flavour, John.
Flavour. Incredible flavour. All grass-fed, no grain. But what that showed me was you don't need – I mean, MSA, I'm a huge believer in the quality of the MSA system, what it delivers for consistency of tenderness. But it showed me that there are other channels that people can go down. In a country like Italy has these European breeds that are – well, in this case, Chianese, enormous, enormous cattle. But the eating experience was exceptionally good. Wow. It was acceptably tender. Was it a marble score 3 Angus? No, it wasn't. But the actual flavour and I think the way it was cooked probably was more to the point. And I did wander out the back and had a look at the chef area. So they used a bar grill that was white hot. It was that hot, you couldn't get near it. And they literally just nuked these bistecas on this plate. And so it's very charry on the outside, still rare at best in the middle, probably too rare for a lot of Australians, but the eating experience was unbelievable. And so, you know, I did learn out of that there's more than one way to produce a satisfying eating experience and probably something that would be, that animal in Australia would have been seriously discounted.
Interesting.
In my opinion.
Yeah. That's great, John. And finally, we're getting to the close. John, we're speaking today, and this will be listened to by Angus producers, mainly family operations. Anything you'd like to leave the Angus community with?
Look, I don't want to end on a pessimistic note, but I just thought I'd like to mention some concerns I have about the seasonal cycles that lay ahead. And what I found over 44 years writing about the beef industry is that it's the issues that are out of our control that have the biggest bearing on the fortunes of the cattle. I'm talking about the cattle end of the industry at the moment. So it's things like COVID, it's things like drought, it's things like market access challenges that completely unexpected but tend to come along and have profound impacts on the industry. So they're all things that are out of our control. But I look at the moment and I suppose I don't want to – I'm sympathetic with the terrible situation that a lot of your constituents have come through in South Australia and parts of Victoria with drought in the past 12 months. But in my part of the world, certainly from the New England and probably central New South Wales north, you know, we've had 4 good years, good to exceptional years in a row. We're heading into a situation where the outlook from BOM for the next 3 or 4 months – again, looks better than normal.
Yes.
And I'm worried about a sense of complacency. People quickly forget how these cycles can turn. We see the beef herd at the moment, MLA's projection, 31 plus million head. And the beef industry in Australia hasn't been over 30 million head all that often in the past. We're creeping up, despite the impact of the southern drought. We're getting to a herd size which I think is exposing us to risk the next time conditions turn particularly dry, which they will. It's just a matter of when. And that worries me on two fronts. First is the feedlot industry in Australia continues to expand in capacity, which is a great thing. But equally, feedlots today are run full all the time. They're running at 90, 91, 92, 93% of capacity. Any more than that is impossible to achieve because of maintenance, pen cleaning. That's full. So the old days when the feedlot industry had this residual unused capacity that got soaked up during times of drought, and the feedlot industry took great pride in providing that service. And I wrote about it. It's all over the feedlot history book that I wrote 10 years ago. Is Robin Hart talks about this as a fundamental part of what the feedlot industry provides for the Australian industry. That spare capacity no longer exists.
It's gone.
Yeah. It's gone. And it will never reemerge because feedlots cannot afford to operate because of their cost structures to operate at less than close to full capacity. What's driven that? Well, we talked earlier about high quality beef demand, marbled beef, but also it's about program business. Everybody has these big brand-based programs, which mean that these feedlots just churn all the time. The next time it gets dry, seriously dry, feedlots don't have that default position for cattle producers to tap into to get them out of trouble. That worries me. The other thing that worries me in this next drought cycle is the ability for the processing industry to kill considerably larger numbers of cattle. This year, we're slightly better than last year. We've managed to recruit a few more staff. You know, the largest kill of the year this year was in the last week of July when it snuck over 160,000 head. It's tailed off since then. If you look at the graph, we're now back in the low to mid 150s. Now, it sounds a lot because we're exporting beef at an all-time record volume. But have a look at 2019 when we were in the middle of a furious drought, continental scale drought across eastern Australia. Kills during that period got to 180,000 head a week. And that was because we didn't have the labour issues back then. We had the staff to handle it. The next time it gets dry, I think we run a serious risk of processors not being able to handle the numbers. And what happens to cattle price then? There's only one thing. It gets absolutely smashed. And it's not the processor's fault. They aren't being cruel or unfair or anything else, but there is a finite capacity to what... Now, processors right now would be killing a lot more cattle if they had the staff to do it. The limiting factor on processing right now, giving international meat prices for manufacturing meat, choice grade, grain fed, is very high and will continue to be so for the next 12 months. But we have no more capacity in the industry to kill cattle than we currently do. And it worries me about the next stage we go through when we get a large drought, not something which is isolated to a region, but has a big drought impact. So yeah, look, I don't want to finish on a pessimistic note, but that is something that sort of I think we need to be thinking about. There's a generation of young beef producers out there at the moment that really don't have much recollection of a serious drought impact, given that it's now 6 years ago. So yeah, that's something I have a concern about.
It's a good cautionary note. John, you're a busy man. We appreciate your time, the insights. Our listeners will be thrilled to hear your story, which is great. And we just really appreciate you taking time out to share some of it. And if that whisper is correct, you've got this quite an acknowledgement of your career ladder this week. So congratulations.
Yeah, no, thanks very much, God. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks, John.
Thanks for joining us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode of The Angus Table. We look forward to bringing you more conversations that support your success in the Angus breed and your farming operation. I'm Scott Wright, CEO of Angus Australia, and today's Angus Table podcast is produced by Mel Strasberg. Until next time, all the best.